this account is going to be much briefer than I'd like it to be, but I have very little time. I have little time to write this, and it has little viability once I post it online. I expect it to be deleted within hours after my posting. Hopefully using a VPN will make it harder to trace and it will stay up longer for someone to read it. To understand what's happening. Although it's unlikely, I'll be able to remain anonymous. I'll be operating under an alias for the moment. In the course of these events, I'll refer to myself as Neenum. It's nonsense. Nothing that can be connected to me. Okay. I live in a small, rural town in southern Minnesota. We have a population of about 5,000 people. The town is about 5 square miles, located on the prairie and surrounded by farmland. To west of the town is a lake about 1/2 mile in diameter. I'll codename the town Little Creek to avoid detection. Probably won't matter anyway. I'm sure all online traces of it will have disappeared within the next few hours. I've lived in Little Creek for 23 years, excluding my time at college. I recently returned in order to take care of my mother, who's been sick. I've never noticed anything strange here. It's always been the definition of quiet country living. These developments happen quickly, and somebody needs to know about them before they continue. I've cataloged them here. I hope to God somebody sees this and understands. April 12th. I returned to Little Creek around 4 in the afternoon. There was road work being done on the interstate as I headed into town. Not unusual. There were also what appeared to be construction workers near the lake to the west of town. They were hauling heavy-duty equipment for something. Once I arrived, I asked my mother about it. She didn't know why they were there. I settled in and moved my things back into my old room. April 13th. I woke up at 6 a.m. Internet was down. I headed to the grocery store at 6:30, where I confirmed with other shoppers that they were experiencing internet problems as well. This isn't uncommon where I live. Being out in such a rural area, there's only one internet service provider. At the store, I ran into a local man I'll refer to as Ben. Ben is known throughout the town for his paranoid delusions. Many people believe he suffers from some kind of disorder, perhaps schizophrenia. He and I had a short interaction in which he claimed that the construction workers at the lake were government officials sent to destroy the evidence of illegal conduct extending back to the 1960s. As we spoke, he became increasingly distressed. Eventually, he left the store and I made my purchases and returned home. By noon, the internet was working again. I searched our local news site for more information about the work being conducted at the lake. I found nothing. April 14th. At 8 a.m., I took my mother to the doctor. While in the hospital waiting room, I encountered various local persons I was familiar with. I asked them about the work being done at the lake. None of them knew what was being done, but they all expressed a desire to know. At 2 p.m., I drove down to the lake. I parked my car on the side of the road and approached the group of construction workers to ask about their work. I was stopped by a police officer. He wasn't a Little Creek police officer either, and he wasn't a state trooper. He informed me that I was trespassing, and that it was too dangerous for me to approach the site. He escorted me to my car and would not answer any questions regarding the lake. April 15th. At 1 p.m., I had another interaction with Ben. He came to my mother's house and requested to speak to me. He handed me several documents and asked me to read through them and left. He wouldn't answer any questions and only stayed for about 5 minutes. I've been unable to scan the documents and upload them onto my computer. Instead, I've transcribed them. He handed me 3 printed newspaper articles and 1 handwritten note. The first article read, "Local boy dies under mysterious circumstances." It was dated June 16, 1972. Daniel Thompson, child of Seamus and Elizabeth Thompson, died last week from an unfortunate and undiagnosed sickness. Daniel, age 10, was admitted to the hospital after a period of severe nausea and vomiting. Over the course of the next few hours, Daniel suffered from fatigueness, dizziness, abdominal pain, and erratic pulse. He died during the night from heart failure. Daniel is survived by his parents, as well as his older brother, Ben, and his younger sister, Christine. The cause of Daniel's sickness is as yet unknown. Anyone with information pertaining to this illness is encouraged to come forward. At the bottom of this article, Ben had written in red ink, "Swimming at the lake," and circled it. The second article's headline said, "Death of 16-year-old linked to Little Creek Lake." It was dated August 4th, 1978. 16-year-old Stephanie Wilson was found dead near Little Creek Lake 2 weeks ago by a local farmer. The cause of Stephanie's death is as yet unknown. However, locals claim that it may have something to do with the lake where she'd been swimming prior to her death. "That lake is bad news," said Timothy Lysette, owner of Little Creek's Good Foods grocery store. "People who go in there don't come out right." Several locals expressed their agreement, but declined to be interviewed for official comment. An autopsy is pending to determine the cause of death for the young woman. Any information pertaining to her death should be brought to the police as soon as possible. There were no markings on this page. The third article was dated September 20th, 2003. The headline read, "Local child is granted wish." Late last Thursday evening, Alex Tonnery was granted his lifelong wish to be the sheriff of Little Creek Police Department. "It's our honor to have such a good officer join us for the day," said Officer Brandy, as he showed Alex her cruiser and gave him an in-depth tour of all its features. Alex, diagnosed last year with leukemia, has been given 6 weeks to live. However, his headstrong and positive spirit shone through even during these tough times. "It'll be sad to leave Mommy and Daddy, but I know I'll get to see them again someday," Alex told us. He was provided with a police uniform and miniature, as well as his own badge. His parents looked on in the distance, taking pictures to commemorate the occasion. "We just want these last few weeks to be happy," Jennifer Tonnery said as she watched her own son become the new star of the police department. "As long as he's happy, we'll know we..." Page cut off here. In the bottom, written in red ink, "Tonnery Farms. Lived half a mile from the lake." And finally, the handwritten note said, "Needham, you're the only person I can trust with this. You have to act quickly because there isn't much time. I know you went out to the lake the other day. You must already know what's..." The rest is unintelligible. The next paragraph picks up and says, "In the 1960s, the site was used for government testing. I told you the other day they made a mistake and they're back to try and clean it up before anyone finds out. It's only a matter of time before someone..." A small bit of it is unintelligible. "They're trying to block any and all information relating to the accident. They know that I know. I don't have much time either. We're all being watched, you especially. Find a way to stop them." Note was left unsigned. April 16th. At noon, I went to look for Ben. He was not at his house. Nobody knew where he'd been. I did not look further. I didn't want to raise any suspicion. I assumed Ben was crazy, but I was also paranoid about what was being done down at the lake. April 17th. At 8 a.m., I was awoken by a scream from outside the house. Upon reaching the window, I saw a child laying outside on the sidewalk. She was covered in vomit. Her skin was red, as though severely sunburnt. Her mother was on her knees, screaming beside her. Before I was able to get my bearings and move toward the door, the mother stopped screaming and began convulsing. She began to vomit as well, her fingers clawing at her throat. After she'd vomited twice, she fainted next to her child. My mother had come down the stairs at that point. She attempted to leave the house to help the woman and her child, but I held her back. Outside, a man stopped his car and left the vehicle to help the woman and the child. He was on his phone, I believe attempting to call for help, when he collapsed on the sidewalk, bringing his hand to his head as though he was in great pain. His skin also began to glow red. I pulled my mother away from the window and sat her down in the living room. I checked to make sure all the doors and all the windows in the house were sealed. We appeared to be safe in the house. I guessed that the people had become sick because they'd stepped outside, leading me to believe that the virus, or whatever it was airborne. I attempted to use the landline to call the hospital, but the phone was out. And then used my cell phone. Hospital line was busy, as was the police line. Turned on the television, but none of the local stations were coming in. I was able to get stations from outside the county, which meant that whatever was happening was local. I decided the best course of action was to try to get my mother and myself out of town. Garage door was closed, so I assumed it was reasonably safe for us to go out to the car. I turned off the air vents, locked the doors, and we attempted to leave on the interstate. We weren't the only ones. Several other town members were heading south on the interstate. However, there was a roadblock set up just 2 miles outside of town. It was being manned by several people in hazmat suits. This confirmed my fear that the pathogen was airborne. They were holding guns. I'm not certain what kind. They shot the windshield of the first car. I can't be sure, but I believe they killed the driver. Female passenger exited the car, screaming. They shot her as well. At this point, I turned the car around and went back the way we came. Several other cars followed suit. The men continued to shoot at the retreating cars. I didn't look back to see if they killed anyone else. I saw two cars get into an accident in their attempts to flee. The drivers stumbled out of the wrecked cars and immediately began vomiting on the side of the road. They tried to flag me down to help them, but I kept driving. We tried driving in the other direction. I saw the roadblock. Before we got close enough to be shot, I retreated back into the town. By the time we returned to the house, the streets were littered with bodies. I had to drive over some of them to get home. Many of them had strange burns covering their skin. Most were covered in vomit. Many were still alive, but it was clear they would not live for very long. We returned to the garage and I shut the door. I instructed my mother to cover her mouth, close her eyes. Got her into the house as soon as I could. Neither of us showed any symptoms of whatever was happening outside. I instructed my mother to lie down in her room, and once she'd calmed down and was resting, I began to gather supplies. I realized that our most direct method of escape, the interstate, is not a viable option. We would need to reassess before we tried anything else. I figured, as long as we were in the house and the vents were closed, which I double-checked as soon as we got home, we would be safe. Once I'd gathered all the supplies I thought might be useful, I went online to do some research. The time was approximately 10 a.m. I began trying to research the symptoms I'd observed in the people laying outside, the people who'd been contaminated. First results that came up on Google were related to acute radiation syndrome. When I attempted to access the sites related to radiation poisoning, however, they were blocked. This was consistent across 4 or 5 different sites. Eventually, I turned on my VPN and was able to access the sites. Not only did the symptoms match those of radiation poisoning, but the majority of the sites also mentioned nuclear fallout and nuclear testing sites as closely linked to instances of radiation poisoning. Over the next several hours, until about noon, I did as much research into nuclear testing as I could. At 12:30, I went to check on my mother. When I entered her room, she was crouched over the garbage can. She'd vomited several times. Skin on her face was red. At this time, I also began to notice I was experiencing a headache. I believe we've both been contaminated. My mother was already very ill. Her body was not able to withstand the radiation poisoning. She's no longer conscious and will die in a few hours. At 2:00, I'll be leaving. I'm going to risk getting into my car and increasing my exposure to the radiation. I believe that if I can get to a hospital in another town, I may be able to survive this, but I have to act quickly. There are dozens of tiny country roads leading out of the town. And careful, I may be able to find one that the government overlooked. Before I leave, I'm detailing what I've learned here. What I think I know about Little Creek, Minnesota. In my research, I stumbled upon something called underground nuclear testing. It's the only testing currently permitted under the Limited Test Ban Treaty. Essentially, nuclear weapons can be tested by detonating them below the surface. If they are detonated far enough below ground that they will be completely contained in the Earth's surface and no nuclear fallout will spread into the atmosphere. Any harmful gases can be extracted and neutralized through controlled tunnel purging. But if the explosion is too close to the surface, it will cause a crater. This is known as a containment failure. Radiation from the blast can escape into the atmosphere all at one time or at small increments over many years. A crater would be an obvious landmark. You would raise questions. But a lake? In the land of 10,000 lakes? Nobody would bat an eye at that. And nobody here would notice the difference between a natural lake and a crater the government had filled with water. That's why the government sent workers to Little Creek Lake. The radiation and hazardous gases were seeping from the lake and infecting the townspeople. The government was hoping to use a controlled tunnel purge to neutralize the gas and radiation. But something went wrong. Something went terribly wrong. Now they're trying to cover it up. They're going to take Little Creek off the map and all of its inhabitants with it. Judging by the number of bodies outside, a number that is constantly growing, they've killed off about 90% of the town's inhabitants. But they haven't gotten me yet. I'm leaving. I don't have much time before I succumb to the radiation poisoning anyway. I might as well try to escape while I have the chance. If I can't, maybe they'll at least shoot me. I'm not stupid. I know I'm not likely to survive the next few hours, let alone the next few days, but I'm going to try anyway. You, whoever you are, you have a future. You're somewhere out there, safe. At least for now. Safe until you hear this. Because once you hear this, the government will know. They'll know I've figured out their secret. They'll know that I've told the world or as much of it as I was able to. And they'll know that there are people out there who know the truth. Please, for the love of God, do something. Because if it happened here, it can happen anywhere. Don't you see? Please, do something before it's too late.
You're going to hell, child of Satan. You'll burn in agony. God will cast thee down. Burn, witch!
That's how I used to begin my morning. Every morning. I live in the same little townhouse that my mother lived in, and her mother before her for as long as I can remember. We've lived next to Miss Thompson, who was perhaps the nastiest person I've ever met. Her voice has assaulted my ears since childhood, either she was yelling at my mother or antagonizing me while I played outside. I don't know how she came to the conclusions that we were witches, but no matter how kind we were to her, her words were always the same. Die, burn in hell, Satan's spawn, witches, bitches. So every morning, I'd walk to my car amid her screeching and try to tune it out as I prepared for the day. After all, it's no good coming to work at a tea house when you're stressed. Your foul mood will poison the tea. At least that's what my mother always told me. Just like our home, the tea house has been in my family for generations. It's always been owned and managed by a woman, and we'd never take employees that just aren't needed. Besides, it's hard to teach a newcomer the finer points of tea making. Me? I've been studying tea since I was a child, as my mother passed down her secrets to me. It's a wonderful job, it's a wonderful life. I quite enjoy it a lot. All except for Mrs. Thompson, of course. Every morning at the tea house was the same. I began by rinsing out the cast iron teapot and teacups. Can't use soap on them, you know, and you can't wash the outside. You can only rinse them, and over time they'll take on the flavor of the teas you brew in them, which is why I have a separate tea set for each kind of tea. Green, black, yellow, oolong, white, and herbal infusions. I'd set the metal teapots to brew hot water on the stove. Can't just put cast iron on the stove either. While prepping the water, I'd select the teas I would feature that day. Of course, a customer can come in and request any kind of tea they like, but I always like to give my own recommendations. I'd open the store at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'd spend the day serving tea. I had quite a few regular customers that enjoyed the healing properties of the tea. People with stomach problems who liked the jade mint oolong. People with anxiety who preferred the chamomile blossom. People who simply enjoyed the traditional taste and brewing process of matcha. Well, one morning, someone new came to the tea house. Someone I never expected to see. Jamie Thompson. Miss Thompson's grandson, who spent most of his time caring for the aging crony, was standing in front of my tea house, watching me serve mango black tea to a few elderly tourists looking for something sweet and strong. "Miss Marnie, so your tea house is doing well?" he began. I noticed the elderly woman staring at him in open appreciation. He was quite handsome, even I must admit, but I ignored him and went back to the tea preparation. Tea takes all of your attention, all of your heart. If you don't give it everything you've got, it will fail you, because you've already failed yourself. Once the tea was prepared and the women were enjoying it iced, I stood up and approached the conspicuous newcomer. "Mr. Thompson, I take it. What can I get for you today?" Most of the time, I'd start by asking what a customer likes, what a customer needs, what ailments are troubling them. I like to help people. But I was wary of Jamie. Nothing good comes from a poisoned plant, after all. "Well, actually, I'm here to get something from my grandmother. See, her mind is going. I read that tea is good for dementia, and I was wondering if you had any recommendations." "It's true. Studies have shown that certain kinds of tea are good at preserving brain mass, but as of yet, nothing in modern medicine is miraculous enough to reverse dementia. Still, nature works in funny ways." I went behind the front counter to examine my selection of green teas. "You know my grandmother. She probably wouldn't drink if she knew you to prepare it." I grunted in assent, not too keen on continuing our conversation. Jamie didn't seem to notice my reticence, or perhaps didn't care. "But you know, I'm hoping that maybe this will help patch things up between you. I think she'd really like you if she got to know you. I've always found you fascinating. I selected some Gyokuro Imperial, and I turned to face him, praising his expression. The light in his eyes told me that he was using his grandmother as a pretense to come see me. Oh. Ignoring his obvious interest, I prepared the tea leaves and rang up his purchase, explaining how they were best brewed and when to drink it for the best results. To his credit, he was very attentive, although he seemed more interested in my lips than the words coming out of them. Well, thanks for this. I'll give it to my grandmother and come back to tell you the results. You needn't bother, I retorted, anxious to get him out of my store. But he smiled in return, not a bit perturbed by my attitude. Oh, you can't get rid of me that easily, Miss Marnie. I'll be back. With that, he turned and strode out of the store, the tourist still gawking at his tall, muscular frame. And that was the start of all the trouble. Since that day, Jamie started coming in regularly, always asking for my recommendations, always claiming that my tea helped his grandmother heal. I sincerely doubted that, but I didn't bother correcting his ignorance. After all, it was just a facade. At the close of each purchase, he would ask me the same exact question. So, do you have any plans for the night? Most of the time, I declined to answer. I had to admit, he was patient and persistent. He never missed a day. He was also sweet in his own way. He handed out compliments like candy, but only ever to me. Sometimes he brought him flowers, although I couldn't keep them in the store. The scent would taint the tea. He brought me sweets on occasion. It was really getting on my nerves. Finally, one day, he didn't immediately ask me out. Instead, he presented me with an opportunity, one that was too good to pass up. Honestly, Marnie, I'll do anything you want just to have one date. What do I have to do? You can't afford a date with me, I assured, although the wheels in my head were already turning. Money isn't an object. Living next to my grandma all these years, you have to know my family's loaded. He flashed me his patent, arrogant grin that somehow managed to hold a certain magnetic charm. Name it. I'll do it. I'll make you understand how serious I am. He seemed serious. And I thought maybe, just maybe, he could be the one I'd been searching for. And if he was, I dare never dream. I grabbed out a post-it and began scribbling the details on it as I told him what I wanted more than anything in the world. There's a tea grown in the Fujian province of China called Da Hong Pao, or Big Red Robe. It grows so high on the mountain that only a few select tea masters are able to pick it. However, what many people don't know is that there are two strains of it, the kind that is sold to the public, and a rare kind that is used in medicine and religious rituals. I glanced into his eyes, but they remained impassive. I dared to finish. I want you to get it for me. He smirked as though he was amused by my reticence. No problem. Is it expensive? I paused to consider that question. The tea itself? No. If you tell them you need it, if you tell them I need it, they'll give it to you. Only you have to fly to China and get it yourself. They won't send it to you. You won't be able to find a trace of them outside of their own little province. They're cut off from the world, and that's what makes their tea so special. Jamie paused as if to consider this, making a very serious face and stroking his chin. Finally, he winked at me. Consider it done. My heart skipped a beat. All this time, searching for the right person, and he'd been right next to me, waiting for me to notice him. Life seemed to move at a glacial pace after that. Jamie bought the tickets and set the date for 6 months after I gave him my request. During that half year, he studied Mandarin with a passion that I'd never seen anyone else before. He'd also managed to track down a Fujianese native and began studying the dialect. He took very careful instruction from me as to how he could find these master tea pickers. The day before he left, he came to see me glowing with confidence, as though he had already succeeded in his quest. I knew that the worst was yet to come for him, but he didn't seem concerned. Before I walked out of my store, he stood in front of me and requested, no, demanded, a kiss for good luck. I was so excited and flustered that I leaned forward and pecked him on the lips without stopping to think. He laughed at the blush suffusing my skin and walked out, anticipating great adventure. Weeks passed. Several of them, in fact, and yet not a word from Jamie. I tried to remind myself to be patient. After all, he had to arrive in China, hike to the mountains, and navigate his way to the secret property of the master pickers. Reaching them would take time, and that's not to mention gaining their trust. I could only hope that they would be a little more compliant when he mentioned my name. And then a few more weeks. I noticed that Mrs. Thompson was too preoccupied to harass me. She seemed shaken by Jamie's absence. Not that it surprised me. He was, after all, her primary caretaker, and though she still managed on her own at this point, she liked the company. I was beginning to think that I would never hear back from Jamie when one morning I arrived at the tea house to find a man sitting in the front of the shop. He was an elderly Chinese man, wearing traditional garb. In his arm, he held a black lacquered chest. My heart stopped. When he saw me approach, he knelt in front of me and kowtowed 3 times. I inclined my head as a gesture of appreciation. Then I opened the tea house and let him inside. We didn't exchange words, although I'm fluent in both Mandarin and Fujianese. Instead, we brewed him a cup of Golden Monkey black tea, which he drank for ritual's sake. Once he finished his tea, he walked out the door and out of my life. But he left behind the chest. My hands shook as I lifted it, feeling its severe heft as I carried it to the back room. Locking the door and closing the blinds, I opened the chest. First thing I saw were the bones. Each and every bone in Jamie's body sat in the chest, neatly packed into a solid mass. I took them out one at a time, spreading them over my work table, admiring their pristine white color. I had never seen something so beautiful. Beneath the bones, separated by a wooden slot, was the tea, the small, dark green leaves with distinct golden flecks. That was how I knew they'd given me the right product. The flashes of gold were the ticket. Yes, Jamie was the one I'd been waiting for, the one I needed, the bargaining chip that got me my most precious treasure. He was the perfect sacrifice. Mrs. Thompson changed after Jamie was officially declared missing. It was assumed that he died while hiking. An inexperienced hiker can easily go missing without the proper guide. And just like that, she found herself alone in the world. Her other children and grandchildren would have nothing to do with her. She stopped screaming at me in the mornings. She stopped coming outside at all. But I couldn't just leave her alone like that. One morning, I brought over a special tea brew just for her. When I knocked on the door, I half expected her to cuss me out, shouting obscenities and misquoted Bible verses. Instead, she led me into her kitchen, and I brewed her tea. I didn't say anything, didn't have to. After a few minutes, she spoke on her own, about how Jamie had been so taken with me, sung my praises until she herself had begun to come around, and how much she always loved him. How her whole life had revolved around him ever since he had been born. She began crying at one point. In fact, she kept crying until I set her tea in front of her. Almost absent-mindedly, she sipped the brew and gave me a surprised look. "This is good." I smiled at her. "It is, isn't it?" It only took a few days to get Mrs. Thompson to agree that I should be her new primary caretaker. Of course, she didn't need much care anymore, not after she began drinking my tea. After a few weeks, her forgetfulness, the signs of her dementia, they began to fade. She was as sharp as she'd always been. Of course, that was intentional. I do, after all, want her to live a nice, long life, full of memories of Jamie and the agony of never knowing what happened to him. It's amazing what a little tea and bone marrow can do to a person. As for me, well, I got what I wanted. I got the rare formula. I need to give my tea healing powers. It's the sacrifice for those brews that require something darker. And without Miss Thompson's ranting and screaming, my mornings became much more peaceful. Which? That doesn't even begin to cover what I'm capable of. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for listening tonight. Not going to keep you all for long tonight. Just got a couple questions. One, did you enjoy the stories? If you did, let me know which one you liked more or which one you enjoyed more down below. What you thought of both of them. Give me your thoughts on all of that. And a quick question for everyone. This question's based on the second story. I'm not going to ask if you believe in witchcraft or anything of that nature. That's a completely different topic for a totally different day. Are you a coffee or tea drinker? And to add on to that, when you have coffee or tea, is it caffeinated, decaffeinated? Do you have sugar? Do you have cream, milk, almond milk, whole milk, oat milk, whatever? Let me know your coffee and or tea routine down below. I think it'd be fun to hear what everybody enjoys in the mornings or at night or even in the afternoon if you need that little bit of pep in your step. Let me know down in the comment section below. Like I said, I'm not going to keep you guys long tonight. Thank you again, everyone, for listening. I hope you all have a wonderful day, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are. And as always, stay safe out there.